Hangtown was thick with killers, robbers, rustlers, horse thieves, card cheats, drunks, wife beaters, whores, swindlers, pickpockets, and a host of petty crooks and mean-minded individuals. Yet in all this collection of flawed humanity, the consensus ranked Sam Heller pretty much at the bottom of the heap. Sam Heller was a Yankee. In Hangtree, Texas, June 1866, a northerner was in a potentially hazardous position. The landscape teemed with well-armed, unreconstructed rebels. The Civil War, as the government in Washington, D.C. insisted on labeling the late secessionist conflict, was officially at an end, everywhere but in Texas. A year and more after General Lee had surrendered at Appomattox, all the states of what had been the Confederacy were at peace, however uneasy, with the Union, but for Texas. The last battle of the war was fought in the Lone Star State at Palmetto Hill in May 1865, a month after Lee surrendered at Appomattox. A year later, the powers in Washington were holding that Texas was still in a state of active hostility. The federal troops garrisoned in Fort Pardee in northwest Hangtree County were as much an occupation force to overawe the local inhabitants as they were a fighting force charged with suppressing hostile Comanches, Kiowas, and Lipan Apaches. The real pains of occupation had not yet even begun. A Yankee stranger in Hangtown, Sam Heller was little better than an outcast, a pariah. A dead shot and relentless foeman who kept coming until an opponent was beaten or dead, Sam had won grudging respect from sullen and resentful neighbors. A respect born largely of fear, but no less real for that. He was known as a man not to be trifled with, best left alone. Sam was on good terms with Captain Ted Harrison, commanding officer at Fort Pardee. On several occasions, he had interceded with Army brass to mitigate some of the rigors of Hangtree's status as occupied territory. It had won him few friends. On this fine Saturday morning in late June, he'd saddled his sure-footed steel-dust stallion at first light and rode out, following the long, slanting slope into the highlands. Riding the hill country alone, he climbed to the summit of the upland plateau, topping the rim of the elevated landform covering much of north-central Texas. Part of it cut diagonally southwest across Hangtree County, dividing it in two. North of the line was highlands, well-wooded hilly country. South lay vast, grassy plains. Most of the population of the county lived on the flat, the ranch lands of Long Valley, watered by the north and south forks of the Liberty River. The Twin Forks joined east of Hangtown, flowing southeast across the state. The uplands were more sparsely settled. Some, not many, ranches and farms could be found there, most sited within 10 miles or less of the plateau's south rim. It was wild country, well-wooded timber broken up by hills and ravines. At midday, Sam trailed south, a fine, fresh-killed buck deer slung across the back of his horse. He'd had good hunting that morning. In his full adult prime, Sam was a rugged, raw-boned titan. 6 feet 2 inches tall, broad-shouldered, deep-chested, and long-limbed. He looked like a Viking on horseback, with a lion's mane of shaggy yellow hair and dark blue gunsight eyes. He wore a battered slouch hat, a green and brown checked shirt, brown denims, and boots. An unusual sidearm hung in a custom-made holster at his right hip, a sawed-off Winchester Model 1866 rifle called a mule's leg. Even cut down at the barrel and stock, it was still as long as his thigh bone. A pair of bandoliers loaded with spare cartridges was worn across his chest in an X. A Navy Colt 36 revolver was stuck in the top of his belt on his left side, worn butt out for a cross-belly draw. A Green River Bowie-type knife hung in a sheath at his left hip. Tied to the left-hand side of the saddle by rawhide thongs lashed to metal rings piercing the leather was a long, flat wooden box with a suitcase grip at one end. Its contents were a welcome equalizer to a man alone. Sam was an outlander, but he had business in that part of Texas. Important business. Government business. And he meant to see the job through. The hostility leveled at him by the town folk was a bit wearing at times, and on such a day it was pure pleasure to ride off by himself into the hills and do some hunting. Deer, an animal more savory and less dangerous than man. When the hunt was crowned with success, well, that was a goodness. Dusty, the horse, didn't mind. He was used to Sam's ways, and the scent of blood and death, animal or human, bothered him not at all. He was a war horse. Back in town, Sam would sell the fresh kill to the butcher, after first having cut out some prime venison steaks. The cook at the Cattleman Hotel would grill those cuts of meat over a charcoal fire, serving them up the way Sam liked, charred at the edges and red and juicy on the inside, with fried potatoes and some cut-up fresh tomatoes. Man, Sam's mouth watered at the thought. He could all but taste it. The hills shrank into mounds, low and squat, as he rode along the trail, opening into a stretch of rolling fields. The sun was hotter without the shade to buffer it, but not too hot. Sam basked in its welcome warmth. The ground sloped upward, rising toward a ridge running east-west. The trail entered a wooded incline, putting Sam once more in the shade. He crested the hill, pausing at the top. Beyond lay a shallow valley, another ridge, and another. The series of ridges and valleys stretched some miles to the southern edge of the plateau. Behind the nearest ridge, a line of smoke rose into the sky, a thin black streak climbing into the heights. Sam frowned. Where there's smoke, there's fire. And where there's fire, there's usually people, which in these parts means caution. He hadn't ridden that way before, having topped the plateau early that morning, several miles farther east. Sighting his prey, he'd tracked the buck northwest into conical hills. Returning, he'd taken a different trail, one that went directly south, instead of retracing his original route along the southeast. The touch of his heels against Dusty's flank started the animal forward, down the far side of the hill. He crossed a valley, uncomfortably aware of its openness. He started up the opposite slope, dotted with stands of timber, and zigzagged uphill, angling from one clump of trees to the next, using them for cover. Nearing the crest, he reined Dusty to a halt and got down from the saddle. Taking the reins in one hand, his left, his right was his gun hand, he led the horse toward the summit.
You're an old woman, Sam Heller, but better safe than sorry.
Careful not to outline himself on the ridge, he looked into the valley below. The smoke feathered up from a charred wagon at the bottom of the deep cleft. Bodies sprawled around it, and the ground in the immediate area showed white, powdered white, as if touched by frost. But it couldn't be frost, not in that heat. Nearing the valley floor, Sam smelled wood smoke from the burned wagon and other less pleasant odors, including burning flesh, human flesh. The big, bulky Conestoga wagon, the kind generally favored by emigrants wending their way westward to new lands, stood about a dozen paces to one side of the dirt road. Its passengers had suffered an interrupted journey. He closed in on it. The horses were gone. They had been cut loose from the traces binding them to the wagon tongue, most likely stolen. Its canvas-topped covering had been consumed by fire. Scraps and shreds of the charred canvas littered the ground nearby. Part of the right-hand side of the wagon was scorched and burned. The rest remained intact. The white powder dusting the ground around the wagon was flour. It had been poured out of a slashed-open sack. Much of it had been poured over the dead. The wagon had been vandalized. Baggage was thrown out of it, suitcases and trunks breaking open upon impact. Ransacked contents pawed over, strewn about the ground. Various items of household bric-a-brac were broken up. Chairs, a table, a cabinet, and sacks of bean, grain, and seed. Robbery and murder were frequent occurrences on the frontier, but this outrage was marked by an emphasis on torture and murder. It was ghoulish bloodletting, executed no doubt with lip-smacking relish. The middle-aged man, squat and stocky, was tied upside down to the right rear wheel of the wagon, braided buffalo hide ropes binding him in place. Underneath him was a slow-burning fire. His face and head were burned beyond recognition. The gray-bearded oldster had been shot several times, none of them fatal. He'd been cut up pretty badly, his naked torso scored with multiple stab and slash wounds. His crotch was worked on with a hatchet, but that wasn't what killed him. He'd been scalped, alive, and then his skull was bashed in by stone-headed war clubs. Nearby lay the corpse of a young girl, thin, scrawny, and long-limbed, about 11 or 12 years old. She'd been shot once through the side of the head. A mercy killing. Sam guessed the old man had shot her before she could be taken alive by the raiders. Cheated of their fun, they'd taken their wrath out on him, killing him by slow degrees. A teenage boy lay face down in the grass, pierced with arrows. The woman, middle-aged and thick-bodied, lay on her back, face up. She'd been raped, of course, not once, but often. She'd been beaten, broken, mutilated, and scalped. The old woman had had similar treatment. As an added refinement, a tree branch had been shoved between her legs and set on fire. Sam could only hope it had been done after she was dead.
Devilments!
Obscene butchery was nothing new to Sam Heller. This outrage figured to be the handiwork of Comanches. Recent reports had reached Hangtown of Comanche raids on the plains west of the Breaks. Isolated incidents, as yet, brutal and alarming, prompted the commanding officer at Fort Pardee to detail a cavalry troop to meet Major Adams's wagon train at Anvil Flats and escort it safely to the Santa Fe Trail. There, it would be met by another cavalry troop from a New Mexico fort. That rendezvous was scheduled for sometime that day. Sam's scalp tingled, with good reason. He wore his yellow hair long, scout style. It was a scout's way of taunting the savages, as if saying, "You can't take my hair." For a moment, the boast rang a tad hollow. Still, he intended to keep his shoulder-length hair intact for a while longer. A good while longer. Or die trying. Sam examined the sign. The marauder's tracks went east along Rimrock Road through the valley. He cut the deer carcass loose and threw it in the brush. Pointing Dusty's head south, he moved forward, climbing the north slope of the far ridge, up and out of the valley, away. Lydia Fisher's 13-year-old legs ate ground at an alarming rate, carrying her away from her home. In an instant, her hard farm existence turned from a struggle to bring life out of the ground into a battle to save her life from the Comanche.
Help! Hey, help!
The raiding party may have already killed her father and brother. She didn't know. She did know her mother shot one attacker. She saw another climb into the house after her mother sent Lydia to run and hide. Now Lydia chased a stranger, hoping somehow he could help. With Sentry Hill on his left, Sam Heller searched for a way off the south rim of the plateau. The uplands were crawling with Comanches, and the sooner he was quits of it, the better the chances of keeping his hair. He'd been ducking scouting parties for several hours. He worked his way east on Rimrock Road, looking for a safe route down the south slope. He'd passed several ranches along the way in the last hour, and the one yonder was the first one he'd seen not burned to the ground. Nearing it, he heard shots. The mule's leg cleared the holster, filling his hand. Looking southward, he saw a long field leading to a ranch house. A girl raced across the field toward the road, waving her arms to attract his attention, crying out to him. He couldn't make out the words, but he didn't have to. Her fear and desperation were plain to see.
Get up, Dusty!
Sam turned Dusty toward her, angling across the field. As the girl stumbled and fell, a Comanche swung into view, charging north. Sam put the boot heels to Dusty's flanks and gripped the reins between his teeth, freeing both hands to work the mule's leg. The Comanche had a rifle. Veering off from his pursuit of the girl, he changed course to meet Sam head-on. Little Bells fired first. Sam fired second, but better, tagging the Comanche dead center. The Indian shuddered. Second round followed, ripping into him. A third knocked him backward off his horse, and Little Bells hit the ground hard. Sam hauled on the reins with his left hand. Dusty slowed. Little Bells' riderless horse rushed past and kept on going. Sam reined in short of the dead Comanche. Nearby, the girl stood swaying, shaken but unhit, gasping.
More of them at the house! More! They got her!
How many?
Don't know!
Go hide in the brush. I'll be back for you. If not, stay there till it's dark and then try to make it to the flat.
Hurry, please! They're killing her!
Sam rode toward the house, coming in on the west side, a shifty tactic that might edge the odds a hair more in his favor. He rounded the corner, entering the dirt yard. Firecloud was on top of Ada, raping her in the dirt. Thorn stood nearby, armed with Greasy Grass's carbine, preferring it to the single-shot musket he'd discarded. Sam reined in hard, pulling Dusty up short. The horse reared, rising on its hind legs as Sam shot Thorn. As the hooves of Dusty's forelegs touched ground, Sam shot Thorn again, watching as he fell in the dirt. Firecloud raised himself up on elbows and knees. Quickly, Ada reached under him, clawing the six gun out of the top of his belt. She shoved the muzzle into his belly and worked the trigger, emptying the gun into him. His gut came undone, spilling entrails. Dying, Firecloud threw his knife and plunged it into Ada, burying it in her heart. Ada and Firecloud were dead, leaving Sam and the girl alone in a country alive with Comanches on the warpath. Johnny Cross and Luke Pettigrew stopped in the Dog Star Saloon, a dive on the south side of Hangtown. The saloon was a long, low, shotgun-style shed. Outside, it was midday. Inside, twilight time. Day or night, a smoky gray dusk compounded of gloom, smoke, and whiskey fumes reigned over the place. A bar ran along one long wall. Tables and chairs were grouped along the opposite wall. The saloon featured raw whiskey at a low tap. A couple of whores plied their trade in a back room. Behind the bar, drinks were served by Squint McCray, proprietor. Two men, shiftless, lazy loafers who were reasonably honest as long as he had his eye on them, worked for him. Some joked that he'd developed the squint from watching the help closely. That was untrue. The squint was the result of a wound sustained in a knife fight, causing one of his eyelids to have a permanent droop. The undamaged eye glared fiercely, as if outraged at having to do the work of two good eyes. McCray preferred to hire relatives. The men were his cousins. One of the whores was his niece. The other whore was unrelated to him, McCray having no other female kin in that line of work. When he caught kinfolk in one of their petty dishonesties, as he inevitably did, he made allowances for them. Being family, he let them off with a roughing up or, at worst, a beating. He didn't have to bust them up bad, club them, cut them, or shoot them, as he might have felt duty-bound to chastise those with whom he shared no ties of blood. As for the whore who was no kin of his, she was scrupulously honest. She turned over to McCray all the money she made from rolling drunks, meekly accepting whatever portion of the loot he doled out to her in recompense. Such docility vexed him. It wasn't natural. As a result, he kept an even closer eye on her. He found himself wishing he could catch her stealing so he could let her off with a beating and break the tension created by her seeming integrity. Watchful as always, Johnny stood with Luke at the head of the bar where it made a little L-shaped jog near the entrance. Angled sideways with his back to the wall, he watched the patrons' comings, goings, and carryings on. He drank with his right hand, his gun hand, his left hanging down loose and easy near the butt of the gun holstered on his left hip. He was faster and more deadly accurate with a gun in his left hand than most men were with either hand. Luke leaned against the bar with his back to the door, facing the rear of the building. He could see the full length of the saloon, all but the entrance, and Johnny had that covered. Between them, they had the whole place under view. They weren't expecting trouble, but they weren't not expecting it either. After all, this was Hangtown. At the bar, you took your drink standing up, since there were no stools. If you wanted to drink and sit down, you took a chair at one of the tables. Had Johnny and Luke been planning to stay a while, they would have taken a table to give Luke a chance to rest his good leg. Luke's feet, the one of flesh and blood and the wooden one, were firmly planted on the sawdust-covered floor. His crutch leaned beside him, propped against the edge of the bar. The Dog Star drew a rough crowd, attracting more than its share of local hard cases. Few were out-and-out villains, but most were no better than they had to be. Small ranchers who weren't above using a running iron to put their brand on other men's cattle, cowboys too ornery or alcoholic or both to hold a job for long, horse thieves, gun hawks, drifters, tin horns, skirt chasers, saddle tramps, a lively crew. The saloon was packed with them, thronging the bar and the tables. Johnny caught Squint's eye, the good one, a round and fiercely glaring orb. He motioned for a refill. McCrae nodded, reaching under the bar for a bottle of the higher line brand of whiskey he kept for more demanding, better-paying customers. He filled Johnny's cup, a wooden tumbler, and Luke's too while he was at it. All the cups in the saloon were made of wood. They cut down on breakage, especially during brawls. Fridays and Saturdays were usually good for a half dozen brawls each night.
Have one on me, Squint.
Don't mind if I do.
McCrae grinned, showing the few teeth he had, black and broken. Setting another cup on the bar top, he poured himself a drink. He raised it.
Bud in your eye.
He didn't mind having fun with his name, so long as he was instigating it. Let somebody else make sport of it, though, and there could be trouble.
Here's how.
Health.
Luke raised his cup. They drank up. McCrae tossed his back like it was water, with as little seeming effect. Johnny drained his cup without flinching, but a deep red flush overspread his bronzed face. Luke did the same, eyes watering, an involuntary twitch firing a couple of times at the corner of his mouth.
Good for what ails you.
Smooth. Yeah.
My special brand. For them what appreciates the quality. Secrets in the aging.
Oh, a whole week, huh?
8 days. It's that extra day that makes the difference.
As long as you're in the neighborhood, might as well hit them again and don't skip yourself.
McCrae refilled the three tumblers.
This one's on the house, boys.
Thank you kindly, Squint.
That's right generous of you.
They all three drank the round slower, a sip at a time.
Ain't seen much of you boys lately.
We've been out at the ranch, mustanging.
Picked a good day to come in, what with the shooting and all.
You see it, Squint?
And leave the place to those no-account thieving kinfolk of mine? Not on your life, brother. Although it almost would have been worth it to see Bliss Stafford get a bellyful of lead.
No bellyful. Shot through the heart.
You seen it, huh?
McCrae leaned forward eagerly, elbows on the bar.
Sure enough. A sweet piece of gunplay it was, too.
Worked out good for me.
How's that, Squint?
McCrae looked around the saloon, his good eye glinting.
Nothing like a killing for bringing them in. Saturdays is always good, but we're doing a land office business. It's the shooting what done it. Folks like to talk it up over their cups, kick it around.
What are they saying?
McCrae looked around, then leaned in farther. There was little worry about being overheard amid the noise and tumult of the hard-drinking, rowdy crowd. But the Dog Star was the kind of place where patrons naturally put their heads together as if cooking up some scheme. Crooked, more likely than not. McCrae was just being confidential and cautious.
You ain't gonna find too many tears being shed over Bliss Stafford. Too bad about Damon, though.
What for? He ain't the one who got killed.
Not yet. But he's not long for this earth.
McCrae shook his head, the corners of his mouth downturned.
Damn shame, though. Him being a genuine hero of the Confederacy and all.
Is that right?
Ain't you heard? Damon was part of that outfit that whooped that Yankee General Banks and his army. Chased him clear out of the Red River country.
Well, that's hard country. Swamp land when it rains, near desert when it don't. And not much good anytime.
Sounds like you've been there.
Just passing through.
After the war, he'd knocked around for a while in the East Texas-Louisiana borderland with Lone Star Hellions Cullen Baker, Bill Longley, and such. Johnny was still wanted in those parts.
Reckon the Staffords will come gunning for Damon?
Depend on it. The old man's a mean one on the best of days, and this ain't gonna be one of them. Not with his fair-haired boy dead with Damon's bullets in him.
A fair duel.
That won't make no never mind to Vince Stafford, no sir. Them other sons of his are a handful, too. Fact is, they could all use killing. Hard to beat, though. Clay's pure hell with a gun, and Quint's meaner than a rattlesnake. And they won't come alone. They'll bring the whole Ramrod bunch, and that's a passel of bad hombres.
Two men came in through the front door, one at a time, cutting the conversation short. The first was about 40, round-faced, with a neatly trimmed black beard. His eyes were bright, calculating. He looked like a prosperous rancher or businessman, well-fed, well-dressed. Those types were at a premium in Hangtown, in all of post-war Texas, for that matter. A pair of big caliber guns were worn holstered low on his hips, below a soft swelling roundness of belly. The bright shrewd eyes and low slung guns didn't quite fit the image of a man of affairs that he presented. The second man was in his mid-20s. His hat was set back on his head so the brim tilted up at a near vertical angle. A brown hat with a round crown, broad flat brim, and a snakeskin hatband. He was thin, bony, sharp-featured, with slitted eyes, a knife-blade nose, and a thin-lipped mouth. A holstered gun was slung low on his right hip, his hand hovering near it. The duo moved apart so that neither stood with his back framed by the open doorway. They stood at the front of the saloon, facing the rear, eyeing the place as if looking for something, or more likely someone. Johnny recognized them. The older man was Wick Jocelyn. The younger was known only as Stingeree. Jocelyn was a gun for hire, a professional with many kills under his belt. Johnny had heard that Jocelyn had tried to sell his services to town boss Wade Hutto. But Hutto already had top gun hand Boone Lassiter on his payroll and wasn't hiring. He wasn't looking to make trouble either, not with a Yankee cavalry troop garrisoned up country at Fort Pardee. Stingeree was a fast young gun looking to make a name for himself. Jocelyn and Stingeree were regulars at the Alamo Bar, a pricey establishment patronized by a high-living, free-spending crowd. A fella could burn through a lot of money fast at the Alamo. Both being at somewhat loose ends, the two had fallen in together. They were suspected of having pulled several stagecoach and highway robberies farther east in Palo Pinto and Tarrant counties, but nothing had been proven against them yet. They'd stayed out of trouble in Hangtown, giving Sheriff Mac Barton no cause to brace them. Wick Jocelyn's restless gaze brushed Johnny's, making eye contact for a brief beat. Johnny nodded, tilting his head an inch or two in casual acknowledgement, not making a thing out of it one way or the other. Jocelyn's gaze moved on, looking beyond Johnny to others, seeking. Finding what he was looking for, he started forward, Stingeree falling into step beside him. Stingeree was a small man who carried himself like a big man, swaggering all cock of the walk. They went down the center aisle, and even in that rough crowd, men made way for them, moving aside. Some men at the far end of the bar signaled for more whiskey.
Like to stand around jawing with y'all, but we got some thirsty folks here.
Johnny slapped a dollar coin down on the bar.
Thanks, gents.
McCray scooped it up and scuttled off to serve some more customers.
Now, some barkeeps, you buy them a drink, they say, oh, I have it later, or oh, I have a cigar instead. Not old Squint. You buy him a drink, he drinks it, by God. I like that.
Hell, he'll even buy you one on the house once in a while.
I like that, too.
Wick Jocelyn's a long way off his stomping grounds.
Luke cut him a side glance.
Well, the dog star's a far cry from his usual fancy digs. What do you figure he's doing here?
Maybe we'll find out.
Jocelyn and Stingeree reached the end of the long aisle. At the left rear corner, an odd trio sat huddled around a table, hunched over their drinks like vultures over carrion. Wild and woolly characters, they looked more like mountain men than cattlemen. All had long hair and stringy beards. Ragged scarecrow figures with harsh, bony faces and hard eyes, they shared a family resemblance. Each of the three wore some part of a Confederate Army uniform. One sported a gray hat with a faded, frayed, yellow-braided hatband. Another was wrapped by a long, tattered, knee-length gray overcoat. The third wore baggy gray breeches tucked into the tops of black cavalry boots. A long-barreled, single-shot, smooth-bore musket was leaning up in a nearby corner. Johnny and Luke eyed the trio nonchalantly as if they weren't looking at them.
Oh, the Fromes boys.
But you know them?
I've seen them around. In Kinto, up in the Nations.
Kinto was a fly-speck town in the middle of a sun-baked plain in what would someday be the Oklahoma Territory. A refuge for deserters, drifters, and outlaws.
They're brothers from the Tennessee Hill Country. Wanted all over the map. They're on the dodge, so they never stay in any one place for too long.
Man, they's really unreconstructed.
They never was constructed in the first place. Zeb, Titch, and Jeter. Zeb's the one with the billy goat chin whiskers. Tetch is the big one. Jeter's the red-haired, sneaky-looking one. The Fromes boys, three of the meanest faces you ever did see.
Well, they look mighty unsociable at that.
Zeb's so sour he'd cross the street to kick a sleeping dog. And I seen him do it once. I should have shot him then.
Despite the crowded conditions in the saloon, the other patrons had left a space around the brothers. The Fromeses sat off by themselves, hunched over their whiskey, glaring out at the world. They looked none too welcoming, but Wick Jocelyn was undeterred. He went to their table, Stingeree lagging behind. The brothers looked up as one. Three sets of hard eyes fastened on Jocelyn, pinning him. Zeb, the oldest, was possessed of a particularly forbidding gaze. Dark irises were completely surrounded by white eyeball, giving an intent, spooky quality to his unblinking stare. Few men could have stood under those gunside eyes without qualms, but Wick Jocelyn seemed unabashed. Jocelyn did some fast talking and not much of it. Just as well, the brothers weren't much for palavering. Whatever his pitch, he must have put it over. The Fromeses exchanged glances, Tetch and Jeter looking to Zeb for guidance. Zeb nodded grudgingly. That went by his way being an invitation. Jocelyn pulled a chair from a nearby empty table, drew it up to the Fromeses' table, and sat down. He motioned to Stingeree, telling him something, giving him instructions. Stingeree went to the bar, shouldering aside several patrons. They were no pushovers, but when they saw he was associated with the evil-faced Fromeses, they sidled off without protest. Stingeree got a couple of bottles and two cups from McCray, bringing them to the brothers' table. He dragged a chair away from the wall and sat down at the table. Neither Jocelyn nor Stingeree sat with his back to the front door. Both angled their chairs around to the sides, so they were partially turned to the front and could keep an eye on it. The chairs extended out from the table like wings. Jocelyn uncorked the bottle and filled Zeb Frooms' cup, followed by Tetch's and then Jeter's. Then he poured for Stingeree and lastly himself. All drank with no particular evidence of good fellowship, cordiality, or even relish for whiskey. Jocelyn did some more talking, not drinking much.
Quite a coalition?
Johnny stepped away from the bar.
Let's mosey. I could use some fresh air.
Luke nodded. Fixing the crutch under his left arm, he swung around, facing the door. He and Johnny went out into the street. No porch or boardwalk fronted the Dogstar Saloon, just hard-packed dirt under their feet. High overhead, the noonday sun beat down, blanketing the surroundings in bright, hot glare.
Now, what do you suppose Wick Jocelyn's about with the Fromes boys?
Cooking up some mischief.
Sure, but what?
Well, whatever it is, it'll probably come to fruit for too long.
Johnny nodded. South of the Dog Star, the buildings were few and far between. A wide expanse of bare dirt mixed with patches of short, tough grass was broken by a handful of straggly trees and bushes. Beyond lay Mextown, where the Spanish-speaking people of the town lived. A cluster of whitewashed adobe huts and wooden shacks grouped around an oval plaza centered by a shallow, water-filled basin. The area was watered by irrigation troughs, fed by a stream snaking across the plain south of town. Small yards and vegetable gardens were marked off by wooden pole fences. A burro, hitched to a pole, walked around in circles, turning a water wheel. A youngster walked beside the animal, beating its hindquarters with a stick when it slowed. West of Mextown lay a big open green space with a rivulet running through it. It was used as a camping ground by westbound wagon trains, Hangtown being the last settlement in New Mexico. The site was occupied by Major Adams's outfit. About two dozen wagons were in motion. Most were Conestoga-style covered wagons, but there were some freight wagons and even one or two high-sided caravan wagons. Hitched to the wagons were teams of horses, mules, or oxen. Scores of men, women, and children thronged the scene. Families, for the most part, along with scouts and others of Major Adams's crew. The wagon train was breaking camp and moving out. It was a slow, laborious process with lots of jockeying for position, balky animals, and clumsy wagon handling. One by one, the wagons began forming into a long, single-file column. The movement kicked up a tremendous amount of dust. Brown clouds rising skyward shot through with shafts of sunlight. The line of the column angled northwest to pick up the Hangtree Trail outside the town limits.
And there go the pilgrims.
Man, them greenhorns can't even hardly form up in a single line without fouling up. It's like herding cats.
Smart to move them out now. The major knows what he's doing. Those folks could only get into trouble in Hangtown on a Saturday night, especially this Saturday night.
They'll wish they stayed put if they cross trails with any Comanches out in the Llano.
They're gonna link up with the cavalry out at Anvil Flats.
Well, anything that keeps the Bluebellies out of town is all right with me.
Amen to that.
Where to now, Johnny?
How about the Golden Spur?
Oh, I knew that was coming.
Johnny tried to look innocent.
Don't you want to see the famous Francine Hayes who drives men wild?
Well, the Staffords would like to see her too, I bet. All hell's gonna break loose when that bunch hits town.
It'll take some time for them to round up their men and ride in from the South Fork.
They've had time.
We're just going for a look-see, Luke. We'll have a drink or two and be on our way before the storm breaks.
You probably even believe it.
Sure I do. I wouldn't have said it.
Some folks, trouble follows them. But you, Johnny, you follow trouble.
Well, I start it. Hell, that's where the fun is.
Well, when you put it that way, I can't say no.
Things have been getting too blame quiet lately anyhow.
Yeah, not for long. I got me a feeling.
The entrance of the Golden Spur opened on a large, high-ceilinged space. A long bar stretched along the right-hand wall. On the left side were tables and chairs, most of which were set aside for gambling. It was set with card tables, a wheel of chance, and birdcage dice games. Opposite the front door, toward the rear of the building, a wide central staircase rose to a second-floor mezzanine, with balcony wings extending along two long sidewalls. Under the mezzanine were rooms used as offices by the saloon's owners, Damon Bolt and his business partner, Mrs. Fry. Ordinarily, by a noontide hour on a Saturday, the Golden Spur would have been doing a brisk trade in gambling, women, and whiskey. Now it was all but deserted, abandoned but for its staffers, a number of whom were about to take their leave. Seated alone at a card table was Damon. Facing the front door, he was playing solitaire, dealing out the cards to himself, arranging them in neat rows by suit and number. The big room was quiet, hushed. A pistol lay near his right hand. A bottle of bourbon and a glass stood by his left. Morrissey, the barkeep, stood behind the bar, wiping the countertop with a damp cloth. It didn't need wiping, but he liked to keep busy. He looked like a barkeep should look. Big, bluff, with hair parted down the middle, a black handlebar mustache, and wearing a striped shirt with sleeve garters. On the other side of the bar stood Creed Teese, the house's resident hired gun. He was loading cartridges into a Henry's repeating rifle. A brown hat with the brim turned up at the sides sat on top of his head. He had a triangle-shaped face, big ears that stuck out, long, narrow eyes, and a bushy mustache. He wore a six-gun on his right hip. He looked like what he was, a working cowboy, one who worked at the way of the gun. The stillness was shattered by the exodus of whores. Mrs. Fry had rounded them up in their rooms upstairs and herded them down to the ground floor. Some of the youngest, freshest whores in the territory, Cherokee, Nicole, Penny, Vangie, Daria, and Kate, they had on their traveling clothes. They were covered up and looked respectable enough. Their bags were packed, carpet bags and suitcases, a hat box or two. Mrs. Fry had burnt orange hair and wore a green satin dress. She was 30, with a long, hoarse face, pinpoint green eyes, thin, sharp nose, and a full-lipped, generous mouth. She was bony, angular, with high, pointy breasts and lean hips. Her long legs, what could be seen of them under her ankle-length dress, were her best feature. She stood at the bar. The whores gathered around her. A few showed grim, white-lipped faces. One or two had moist eyes and quivering chins. They would have taken it a lot harder if Mrs. Fry hadn't already paid them off for their work up to date. That was Damon's idea. He always paid his debts, for good or ill. At Mrs. Fry's prompting, Morrissey poured out shots for all. She raised her glass.
Drink up, gals. Time's a-wasting. It ain't often the house is buying, so get it while you can.
At the table, Damon filled a shot glass. He rose, holding it up.
Your very good health, ladies. Until we meet again, may it be soon.
The sooner we get back to business, the better.
She raised her glass a little higher.
Luck!
She tossed her drink back like a man, unflinching. The others drained their glasses fast or slow, according to their tolerance for strong drink. Having emptied his glass, Damon threw it against the wall. Some of the girls jumped. He sat down, picked up the deck of cards, and resumed playing his game of solitaire where he'd left off. Mrs. Fry set her glass on the bar.
On your way, girls.
She turned around.
Swamper!
Yes, ma'am!
The man came shuffling to the fore. He was a derelict old drunk who was kept around to do various scut work and chores in return for room and board. His lodgings consisted of a bedroll in the corner of the kitchen, and his board was made up mainly of whiskey. He had long, stringy gray hair, bloodshot eyes, and a face full of broken, spidery blue veins, where it was not covered by a straggly beard. He wore a red and black flannel shirt, bib denim overalls, and hobnailed boots. An oversized horse pistol was stuck into a hip pocket, gun butt jutting out.
Take the girls over to Honey Bailey's.
Honey was a brothel keeper, a friendly rival. Her house was a few streets north of the spur. Mrs. Fry turned to the girls.
You girls can stay at Honey's until the trouble's blown over. Worst comes to worst, you all find work there. But what you've got to sell, none of you will have to worry about starving.
She turned back to the swamper.
Take him out the back way. Wait until Monk gives you the word.
Yes, ma'am. Come on, ladies.
The women picked up their bags. The swamper started toward the rear of the building, weaving slightly, and the women followed.
Good luck, Damon.
Well, thank you, my dear.
Get on with you. Don't bother the man.
The swamper led them through a passageway behind the staircase to the back door that opened onto Commerce Street and the relative safety of the other house. Mrs. Fry watched the last of the women leave, then turned to study Francine.
You all right, Francine?
Yes, Mrs. Fry. I'll be in my room.
Francine climbed the stairs to the second floor, crossing the balcony to a door, opening it and going inside. Mrs. Fry cut a glance at Damon. He poured her a drink. Damon went to the table, sat down, and resumed his card game. Johnny Cross and Luke Pettigrew entered the Golden Spur.
We're closed, gents.
Oh, Miss Fry. After I done hump my way over here on my one good leg, you ain't gonna send me away without one measly little old drink?
Save the blarney. You walked in, you can walk out.
Now I think we can make an exception, Mrs. Fry. Belly up, gentlemen. Have one on the spur.
Let's go!
You're a gentleman, Damon.
Emma. Well, how nice it would be to think so.
Johnny and Luke made their way to the bar.
Howdy, Creed.
Creed.
Creed Tease wiped down the bar in front of the boys.
Hey, y'all.
How's it going?
Can't complain. You?
I'm getting along.
Morrissey poured drinks for Johnny and Luke. They downed them, setting empty glasses on the countertop. Johnny slapped a coin down.
How about letting me buy one?
Tease nodded.
Why not?
Morrissey poured three shots.
Pour one for yourself.
Thank you kindly.
The barkeep filled a fourth glass.
How about you, Miss Fry?
I'll pass, cowboy, but I'll take your money.
Now, Mrs. Fry.
The way things are going today, we could use it. Well, all right. I can't say no.
I heard that about you.
No to a drink.
Well, I heard that too.
She gave Luke a hard look as she ambled over to the bar.
Don't push your luck, Hayseed.
What'll you have, Damon?
This'll do me just fine, thanks.
Damon reached for the bottle on the table and refilled his glass.
Mud in your eye.
They drank.
Enjoy yourself while you can. The climate here's liable to turn distinctly unhealthy any time now.
That so?
Too much lead in the air.
Maybe sooner than you think.
Wick, Jocelyn, and Stinger E came in through the front door.
They dogging us, Johnny?
Dogging somebody, maybe. Keep a close hand by that scatter gun.
Always do.
Creed Tease glanced at the newcomers, his gaze hooded.
Something I should know about.
Stay loose and ready.
Those two clowns.
They've been making some new friends lately.
Damon kept turning up the cards and placing them down slowly and deliberately. Mrs. Fry went into the office, closing the door behind her. Wick Jocelyn walked softly, carefully putting one foot before the other as he advanced toward the end of the bar nearest the entrance. Stingaree swaggered alongside him, all loose-jointed. They stopped more or less on a line with where Damon was sitting. The saloon owner went on playing cards, seemingly oblivious. Wick Jocelyn looked around, scanning the scene. His gaze took in Johnny and Luke, and he nodded to them.
Looks like you boys had the same idea as us.
Oh? What's that?
To have a drink here, what else?
Jocelyn rapped his knuckles on the bar.
Whiskey, barkeep.
Make it two.
Morrissey picked up two glasses and a bottle, carrying them to the end of the bar. He set down the glasses and poured. Wick Jocelyn laid a few coins on the counter. He turned and raised a glass in his left hand.
Nice shooting today, Damon.
Damon glanced up.
I'm still here.
Couldn't have done it better myself.
No?
Hell, Wick's just being modest. He could do better.
Well, could be.
Damon turned over the cards. Wick Jocelyn's face split in a broad grin.
My young friend here tends to get overly excited. Something about a gunfight does that to him. Don't mind him.
Oh, I don't.
He snapped down a card, black 10 on red jack.
You got my admiration. It takes plenty of guts to go against Vince Stafford.
Creed T sighed Jocelyn.
You a friend of his?
I don't even know the man. I know of him, though. Hard not to. He throws a long shadow, him and that ramrod outfit of his.
He spoke not to Tease, but to Damon.
Stafford's not likely to take too kindly to you putting his boy in the graveyard.
So where do you come in?
Another card snapped down on the table. Red 5 on black 6.
Stafford's got a lot of guns riding for his brand. Maybe you could use a couple good guns on your side to kind of even up the odds.
Black 8 on red 9.
You selling?
You buying? Our guns are for hire, Stingaree and me, but we don't come cheap.
Jocelyn indicated Johnny and Luke.
Maybe you've already hired on those two.
Leave us out of it. We came in for a drink.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
So much the better. That leaves us a clear field to play.
Any gun can play.
Wick Jocelyn looked around.
Nice place. You must make a lot of money, Damon.
Barely breaking even with all the overhead.
Damon turned up a card. Red Queen. He laid it on a black king.
Bosh, you're poor mouthing. I appreciate horse trading, but time's running out.
Oh?
Stafford's liable to ride in any time.
You don't say.
Noise sounded at the back of the building like somebody bumping into a chair. Damon placed a black ace on a red deuce. Ace of spades. Death guard. Three men came rushing out of the rear passageway, out from behind the staircase. Zeb, Tetch, and Jeter, the Fromes boys. Johnny Cross had been looking for the Fromeses from the moment Jocelyn and Stingaree entered. Johnny stepped away from the bar, filling his hands with the twin 44s holstered at his sides. Zeb leveled his musket hip high and swung the musket toward Damon. Johnny struck first, ventilating. On either side of Johnny, Tetch and Jeter, six guns in hand, blasted away. At the first sign of trouble, Damon snatched up the gun on the card table, firing even as Wick Jocelyn and Stingaree slapped leather, hauling out their guns. Stingaree was fast, his gun clearing leather first, but Jocelyn was in his way, blocking the shot. Trying to make his own, Damon and Jocelyn fired at the same time. Jocelyn missed. Damon scored, dropping a 45 round in Jocelyn's middle. Wick Jocelyn's face contorted in agony. He seemed to implode, shrinking into himself, falling back against Stingaree. Gun in hand, Stingaree fought to get clear, angling to open up a line of fire. The top of his head exploded, spewing blood, brains, and bone. He'd been felled by the gun in Creed Tease's hand. A bullet from Tetch Fromes's gun punched a hole into the side of the wooden bar near Johnny Cross. Johnny returned fire, tagging Tetch, knocking him down. Johnny shot Jeter Fromes, first dropping him to his knees as he tried to bring his gun up, then between the eyes. Tetch was up on one knee, holding his gun in both hands, swinging it toward Johnny. Luke opened up with his sawed-off shotgun. Tetch came apart in the middle, a raw red mess spilling loopy gray strands of intestines where his belly had been before being pulped by buckshot. A cloud of gray-white gun smoke hung in the air in the middle of the big room. Bodies littered the floor. Behind the bar, Morrissey straightened up, shotgun in hand. When the shooting started, he ducked down and grabbed for the weapon he kept handy in case of trouble. But by the time he brought it up and clear of the bar, he was too late. That's how fast the action had gone down. The victors looked around, guns in hand. No more challengers presented themselves. The bullet-pierced mirror came undone all at once. Finally, the office door at the rear of the building opened, an orange-haired head cautiously peeking around the corner of a doorframe. Mrs. Fry looked out, surveying the carnage.
Oh, God.
You can come on out now.
At the left rear corner of the second floor, a vertical wooden ladder bolted to the wall rose to a square-shaped hatch in the ceiling. A head and a pair of shoulders came thrusting out of the hatch. Monk looked down at the main room below.
You okay, boss?
Oh, yes.
Anybody hurt?
Nobody important.
What happened?
Somebody made a bad bet.
Monk climbed down the ladder, a rifle in one hand. He was balding, bullet-headed, bearded, with powerful shoulders and arms and bowed, bandy legs. He crossed to the edge of the balcony and leaned over the balustrade, surveying the carnage below.
Woo-wee! Who's them debtors? Staffords?
Outriders trying to cut in.
Mrs. Fry stood with hands on hips, head tilted, looking up at Monk.
Where were you when they sneaked in through the back?
Up on the roof.
A fine lookout you are.
Staffords got to come in from the south. I was watching for them. Can't look everywhere, Miss Fry. It's a big roof.
Get back up there and keep your eyes open this time.
Yes'm.
Monk went to the ladder, scrambling up through the trapdoor hatch, out of sight. Francine came out of her room and stood at the balcony rail.
Everyone all right?
The ones on our side are. Come down and join the party.
Oh, no thanks. I think I'm gonna be sick.
Turning, she hurried back into her room. Damon faced Johnny.
That's gutsy play, that, turning your back on Jocelyn and his partner to shoot it out with the brothers.
I'm a betting man myself. I figured you and Creed could handle Wick and Stingery.
Oh, quite a gamble.
Johnny shook his head, smiling.
A sure thing.
Now, your faith in us is heartening, if possibly misplaced. In any case, I thank you, sir. I thank you both. And now, I suggest you clear out while you can before Stafford arrives.
What, and miss all the fun?
Fun, he calls it. If you think tying into 24 red-hot killers is fun.
Happens I do. It wouldn't be the first time, neither.
Why buck the ramrod? Vince Stafford's got no grudge against you.
It's early yet.
Wait till he gets to know us a little better.
I don't get it. What's in it for you? I mean, why make this your fight?
Damned if I know. Maybe because the Spur is the one place in town with square deals, straight-up card games and dice. No crooked tables or watered-down whiskey. Maybe I like the way you handled yourself, Damon, when young Stafford braced you. Or maybe I was overdue to kill Zeb Fromes for kicking an old hound dog who never did him any harm. I got distracted that day and Zeb got away from me. Could be I'm just a natural-born rebel with the liking for lost causes and kicking up trouble and siding with y'all's promises to deliver plenty of both. Who knows? Like I said, I ain't entirely sure why myself.
Mrs. Fry gave Luke the once-over, appraising him with cold-eyed calculation.
And you? Where do you fit in all this?
Me? Oh, I'm with him.
A slight smile played around Damon's lips.
Betting on the Golden Spur now could be considered a long shot.
Them's the kind that pays off best.
Damon reached into one of his pants' front pockets, pulling out a fat roll of high-denomination greenbacks.
The house always makes good.
Whoa, put your money away. I ain't sniffing around for a payday.
Well, the workman is worthy of his hire, they say.
When I sell my gun, that's business. When I side with a man, that's different. Money's got nothing to do with it.
Damon stuffed the roll back in his pocket.
Well, my apologies, sir. I misread the situation. No insult meant or implied.
None taken.
A couple of go-to-hell Texas gun hawks in for the fun of it. The funny thing is, with you two, I almost believe it.
Of course, you want to buy us a drink or 10 to show your appreciation. We wouldn't take that as an insult. Not even a little bit.
You got yourself a deal, stud.
Presently, Damon, Mrs. Fry, and Creed Tease were all called away on various errands relating to the reception they were preparing for Vince Stafford and company. Morrissey was at the other end of the bar, removing bottles from the back shelf below the mirror and stowing them under the wooden counter for safekeeping. Johnny and Luke were by themselves for the moment.
I don't get it. Why not take Damon's money if he's giving it out?
The friendship of a man like Damon Bolt's worth more than money. That's a friend worth having if we mean to stick in Hangtown.
If you don't get killed, or we don't.
That's where the gamble comes in. I'll take a chance on him, and I sure ain't gonna bet against us. Trust me, once the ball starts rolling, there'll be plenty of money to pick up from action on the side.
You're calling it, Hoss. Too much thinking makes my head hurt.
I think that's the whiskey.
Wade Hutto and Sheriff Mac Barton walked in. They came alone, just the two of them, to show their lack of hostile intent. Deputy Smalls and a half dozen hangers-on from Hutto's party waited outside. The sheriff of Hangtown had no hangers-on, except maybe Deputy Smalls. Barton had the glum, stolid air of a man doing a disagreeable duty.
Now what?
Edda came in looking for trouble. They found it.
You're in an all-fired hurry to get yourself killed.
Yet they are dead, while I am still alive.
Barton circled the three bodies stretched out in front of the staircase, each outlined by handfuls of sawdust the swamper had spread on the floor around them to soak up the blood. The sheriff cheered up at the sight of the corpses.
The Fromes boys. It was only a matter of time before they got shot or hung. Saves the town the price of three hangman's ropes. That's a break.
Any reward on them?
Not in Hangtree. Who killed Jocelyn?
That'd be me.
And Stingery?
Creed Tease nodded.
Mine.
Barton didn't take any notes. It wasn't an investigation. He was just curious. He rejoined Hutto, who stood to the side, facing Damon. Hutto shook his head.
That's how it begins. Vince isn't even in town, and already there's killing.
It wipes five undesirables off the books at no cost to the taxpayers.
There is that.
Mrs. Fry came out from behind the closed door of the office, where she'd been fortifying herself with a glass of whiskey and a laudanum chaser. Their medicinal tincture of opium, laudanum, was widely available with no prescription needed, despite its addictive properties. The drug contracted the pupils of her eyes to pinpoints.
How about getting those bodies out of here?
Mrs. Fry turned on Barton.
What's the law going to be doing when Stafford makes his move?
I'm working on it.
I bet.
Try the Dog Star.
Johnny Cross and Luke sat at a table between the bar and the front door.
I hear the Ramrod brand ain't too popular around there.
Where do you fit in this, Cross?
Just helping out.
Careful you don't help yourself into Boot Hill.
Oh, I'll be careful, Mr. Hutto. Very careful.
Bah!
Hutto was one of those fellows who can say bah without looking ridiculous. He turned to Damon.
You could help by clearing out of town and take that Francine Hayes with you.
Damon glanced with seeming mildness at Hutto, who immediately looked away, not wishing to maintain eye contact.
You touch me on a point of pride, sir. Miss Hayes is entirely blameless in this matter. She's the offended party here. Now, it's no fault of hers that a boy like the late Bliss Stafford tried to force unwanted detentions on her. Now, I'm sure you agree that I did what I had to do, and that no Southern gentleman could do less.
I'm not arguing the point. Legally, you were in the right. Isn't that so, Sheriff?
A clear-cut case of self-defense.
But Vince Stafford won't see it like that. He'll make it a blood feud. Him and Clay and Quint, they'll have 20 guns and more backing him up. You're a gambler. You know better than to buck those odds. Get out of town.
That would make things easier for you.
You're damned right it would.
If you were me, would you run?
I'm not you, and right now I'm damn glad of it.
And you, Sheriff, would you run?
It's not the same.
Barton fidgeted, uncomfortable with the question.
Why not?
I wear a badge. A lawman who runs is finished, washed up.
It's the same with me.
You're dead if you stick.
Well, I'll take that bet.
Oh, your fine talk about the law. What about Damon? The law's supposed to protect him, too. Where's Hangtown gonna be if you let Stafford ride roughshod over it?
Hutto was silent.
I'll do what I think is best for every man, woman, and child in Hangtree. What happens to them if I get killed trying to keep Vince from doing what he's hell-bent for leather on doing, namely evening up on Damon for killing Bliss? Who stands between him and them, then? I'll do what I can to head him off, but don't expect miracles.
You're not a gambling man, Sheriff.
Not when the whole town is part of the ante. Sorry.
That's all right. I'll pull my own chestnuts out of the fire.
We're through here. Coming, Barton?
Yeah.
Hutto started for the front door. Barton followed, taking a few steps and then turning back.
I'll do what I can, but I ain't making no promises.
Can't ask for more than that.
For what it's worth, good luck.
Sam stepped out of the settler's house to see the girl standing at its southwest corner, her flat-eyed gaze taking in the whole scene. She stood very straight, hands clenched into fists at her sides. Her face was deathly pale. Sam went to her, trying to get between her and the bodies to block her view. He hoped she wasn't going to scream. He was in a tight enough spot without her going into hysterics. They both were. Not that he would have blamed her for throwing a fit. Sam studied her face. Her eyes were wide, dry. A nerve twitched in the corner of her mouth. No way to sugarcoat it. Best say it the way it was.
Your people are all dead. I'm sorry.
She started forward, but he stood in her way, stopping her.
There's nothing you can do for him. I checked.
She nodded, holding herself so taut that Sam wouldn't have been surprised to hear her corded neck muscles twanging with the movement. He watched her intently. She didn't scream, didn't faint.
Are you hurt?
She shook her head.
I've got to leave you for a minute to check on those two braves behind the house, make sure they're dead. Will you be all right?
She nodded yes.
If you hear any shots, that'll be me, so don't let it scare you. I'll be right back. Then we're gonna get out of here.
Sam stepped around her, starting forward, then paused.
Your folks are safe from hurt now. Best not to look if you can. You don't want to see them.
She was silent, staring at the bodies. Sam went around to the back of the house, drawing the mule's leg. He fired a shot into the head of each brave, loaded two fresh cartridges into the receiver to replace the ones he'd expended, and returned to the front of the house. The girl was nowhere in sight. Sam's flash of alarm was stilled by the sound of movement coming from inside. She came out through the doorway carrying a stack of folded blankets. Setting them down beside the body of her mother, she took the blanket off the top of the pile, unfolded it, and spread it over the corpse. Sam was reassured somewhat. The youngster was taking it better than he had thought she might, having just survived the slaughter of her family. Plenty of adults, even hardened frontier types, would have gone to pieces from the experience. But she might shatter any time at the drop of a hat. Sam knew they had to keep moving. Picking up a blanket, he covered the man, boy, most of him. A few body parts were scattered out of reach of the blanket. He helped the girl lay a blanket over her father. She turned, starting toward the house.
Where are you going?
Getting a gun.
Sam had been unsure if she had been shocked into speechlessness. That she could talk was heartening. He needed all the encouragement he could get. Things looked mighty grim for them. He'd been lucky to evade several bands of braves earlier after first encountering the slain emigrants in their half-burned wagon. Alone, it would have been touch and go whether or not he could slip the net of Comanches he'd seen covering the area. With a youngster in tow, the odds against him went up dramatically.
Make it fast. We gotta move.
Lydia went inside, making no reply. A minute or two later, she returned, carrying a rifle and a box of cartridges. It was a Henry's, a repeater, a good gun. She took some cartridges out of the box and started loading it. She handled it like she knew what she was doing.
We're in a heap of trouble, miss. The upland is thick with Comanches. Looks like the whole blamed tribe is on the warpath. More could come along any minute. We've got to get down to the flat, fast. Later, when it's safe, we can come back and give your folks a Christian burial. But now we gotta run. Savvy?
I savvy.
Good. Let's mount up and ride.
I'll take Brownie.
Brownie? Who's that?
My horse. I'm not leaving him behind.
Brownie, a strong, solid-looking gelding with good lines, was in the corral. The girl calmed the animal, skittish from the blood and violence. She saddled him, then stuffed her deep pockets with cartridges for the rifle while Sam corralled the Indian ponies and the other animals. He didn't want them wandering off, attracting Indian scouting parties to the ranch.
My name's Sam. Sam Heller. What's yours?
Lydia's eyes narrowed.
Why?
So I can call you something besides Miss.
You talk funny. You're a Yankee.
That's right.
Miss will do just fine, thank you very much.
The war's over, in case you hadn't heard.
That's a sneaking Yankee lie. God bless the Confederacy and Robert E. Lee.
Sam showed a quirked half smile.
Comanches don't make no difference between Yankees and rebels, you know.
Well, I do.
Lydia Fisher had been raised to believe that Yankees were the devil. The stranger had no tail, and if he had horns, they were hidden under his hat. But she trusted him no more than she had to. Trouble was, she had to. At least until she was off the plateau and safe among decent, civilized southern folk. As Sam mounted up on Dusty, Lydia swung herself up on Brownie's back. The horse's eyes bulged, nostrils flaring. He pawed the ground, sidling. Leaning forward, Lydia patted Brownie's muscular neck.
Easy, Brownie, easy. We'll be all right soon. Easy, boy.
You sure you can handle him?
Don't worry about me, Mr. Yank. Brownie will be okay once we get away from here.
What's the fastest way off the plateau? Can we get down from there?
Sam pointed directly south where a ridgeline screened the edge of the plateau from sight.
Can't go that way. It's too steep. No way down. The nearest trail's Hopper Glen, a half a mile or so down the road.
Can we go through the woods? Any trails?
The brush is too thick. Gotta take the road.
Great.
Sam and Lydia rode between the house and the woods, north across the field. Sam rode ahead to scout Rimrock Road, bordering the edge of the property. It was empty in both directions, as far as the eye could see. Lydia came alongside him. They turned right on the road, going east. She didn't look back at the ranch, not once, not even a glance.
You look like you know how to handle that rifle.
I do. Here in the hills, it shoots straight the first time or you don't eat.
Lord knows you got plenty of reason to want to even up. But don't shoot straight off if you see a Comanche. Make sure he sees us first.
What do you expect me to do, throw flowers at him?
Just don't give away our position if you don't have to.
After a fifth of a mile, the belt of woods on the south gave way to fields dotted with dirt mounds and stands of timber.
Let's stay off the road if we can. The Comanches are out in force.
They turned right, angling southeast for several hundred yards. A game trail wound east through low, rounded hills. They followed it a while.
We're coming on the Oakley Ranch.
Where?
Not far. There's a brook, then a rise. It's on the other side.
A low, tree-covered ridge ran north-south, the stream winding along its western foot. Smoke showed over the treetops, a hazy gray curtain. Sam reined to a halt, Lydia pulling up beside him. Sam shucked the mule's leg out of its holster, holding the reins in his free hand. Lydia looked stricken.
The Oakleys?
The Comanches got there first.
Maybe it's not too late to help.
Hear any shooting?
No.
It's too late, girl. The Comanches have already been and gone. Any Oakleys left alive, they'd be shooting, and the Comanches would be shooting back. It's over.
You don't know that for a fact.
I ain't risking my hair to find out, you.
No.
Let's get clear. If we can.
Sam pointed his horse north, Lydia following.